Thank you, Susan, so much for the meditation this morning, getting us centered, still, ready to hear the Dharma. So this morning is the last Sunday of the month that we're going to meet. So that means that we're wrapping up our focus on practicing with wealth in our daily life. And I'm going to start with not a story. It's a poem. It's a poem by Mary Oliver. It's a little different from her usual poems. It does have a little bit of story with it. And it's called The Black Walnut Tree. My mother and I debate. We could sell the black walnut tree to the lumberman and pay off the mortgage. Likely, some storm anyway will turn down its dark boughs, smashing the house. We talk slowly, two women trying in a difficult time to be wise. Roots in the cellar drains, I say. And she replies that the leaves are getting heavier every year and the fruit harder to gather away. But something brighter than money moves in our blood. An edge sharp and quick as a trowel that wants to dig and sow. So we talk, but we don't do anything. That night, I dream of my father's out of Bohemia, filling the blue fields of fresh and generous Ohio with leaves and vines and orchards. What my mother and I both know is that we'd crawl with shame in the emptiness we'd made in our own and our father's backyard. So the black walnut tree swings through another year of sun and leaping winds, of leaves and bounding fruit, and month after month, the whip crack of the mortgage. I remember when I read that poem in her collection of poems, that, and it just kind of jumped out at me because it didn't seem, you know, as spiritual as and natural as a lot of the others that I was inspired by. But boy, it hit home, that phrase, the whip crack of the mortgage. And I could identify with making those kinds of choices. And I'm reading this poem because for me, the poem speaks of values and choices that we as householders, lay practitioners, have to make about money and wealth. And how we as
Lauren, you have to unmute yourself. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just did.
Thank you.
Was I muted the whole time?
No, I just saw a note.
Yeah, just suddenly muted. Okay, so did I say, I'll just repeat the sentence. I don't know where it went. So to me, the poem speaks about values and choices. That because we're householders and lay practitioners, we have to make about money and wealth. And because we're lay practitioners, we're trying to be wise. So there's the idea of the value of wisdom and values in dealing with money for us. And last night I was listening to a talk by Joseph Goldstein. It was on Right View, and he was talking about American values, our cultural values. And he said, let's see, what are our values? Well, wealth is certainly one of our values. And then he went on to say that in other cultures and in other times, wisdom has had more value. And that if you went into a village and you asked to be introduced to the wise people or the wise men, they would have directed you, or wise women. Of course, wise men is from the olden days, so I'm trying to be more gender balanced. But you would be directed to wise person the wisdom was valued, and certainly in the Dharma, the two wings are compassion and wisdom. So I think this is something we do have to reflect on, and I'm going to bring that up a lot during this talk today. Something brighter than money was stood out for me in the poem. And money is supposed to buy some degree of happiness, but sometimes we make choices that go against the happiness money can buy. We'd really like to have happiness, the money that happiness can buy, the happiness that money can buy, excuse me, and the happiness that money can't buy too. But sometimes we have to choose one or the other. And it seemed like in this poem, that was what Mary Oliver and her mother were dealing with. The other line that stood out for me was at the end, month after month, the whip crack of the mortgage, the threat of ruin, the loss of security, and the fact that fear often comes into our relationship with money. So earlier in the month, we asked you to write in the chat about some topics that you wanted to discuss, and we've come up with more along the way. Some of those topics that we have talked about are the state of mind of abundance and prosperity, and the state of mind of experiencing enough, as opposed to a state of mind of scarcity, feeling trapped in suffering. And one person said, where the late fees are piling up. And then there's the poison of greed. We might have to deal with that issue. We talked about bringing equanimity and peacefulness to the experience of having money, as well as when we don't have money, to have equanimity and peacefulness. And we talked about dana and generosity and how much is just the right amount. Finally, we talked some about how pressures from our society reinforce our tendency to identify with our perceived wealth or our perceived lack of it. Our society and economic system have a lot of labels and stratification. There's a lot of categorizing based on wealth with a lot of consequences. And when we think of dependent origination and the tenth link of becoming, we can see how craving and clinging lead to becoming and our identification with wealth. All month, across all these issues, Tuwery has emphasized that our practice with wealth is to use right effort to sit with our relationship to wealth and investigate our views and assumptions, beliefs, and habits, the joy as well as the suffering around money, and feelings of abundance and privilege, as well as feelings of scarcity and fear, and maybe greed. Today, we're going to have a good amount of time to discuss the issues that are important to you. We already heard some references to the Buddha's suttas, in which he said it was okay. It's a good thing to have wealth if you acquire that wealth through right effort and your own hard work, and if you use the wealth for wholesome purposes. I'm going to refer to, I looked up two suttas because I really wanted to familiarize myself with what he said in those suttas. And I came up with two that I thought would be helpful to us in figuring out how to practice with our relationship to wealth. So both suttas were addressed to householders who had questions about wealth. The first one is called the Adiya Sutta. I think that's how you pronounce it. And this one talked about the benefits of wealth that the Buddha said were there for the householder. He said to this householder, a disciple of the noble ones, which is what we are, whose wealth is earned through, quote, his efforts and enterprise, amassed through the strength of his arm and piled up through the sweat of his brow. This is righteous wealth righteously gained. There's a quote, a verse that one of these householders might be able to recollect about himself regarding wealth righteously gained. So this is the verse. My wealth has been enjoyed, my dependents supported, protected from calamities by me. I have given supreme offerings and performed the five oblations. I have provided for the virtuous, the restrained, followers of the holy life. For whatever aim a wise householder would desire, wealth, that aim I have attained. I have done what will not lead to future distress. When this is recollected by a mortal, a person established in the Dhamma of the Noble Ones, he is praised in his life and after death rejoices in heaven. So in summary, the Buddha is saying there's five righteous purposes for wealth. One, providing for one's family, servants, and in the sutta, it said slaves. Two, providing for his friends and associates. Three, warding off calamities coming from fire, flood, kings, thieves, hateful heirs, and for keeping himself safe. The fourth one is performing the five offerings to gods, to relatives, to guests, to the dead, to kings, and to devas. And the fifth, and this is an offerings of supreme aim. And supreme aim results in happiness leading to heaven. And those offerings are given to Brahmins, contemplatives who abstain from intoxication and heedlessness, who endure all things with patience and humility, each taming himself, each restraining himself, and each taking himself to unbinding or awakening. So the Buddha seems to be stressing that there is still a lot of discernment. One can enjoy, you know, the benefits of wealth, but one needs to consider also generosity and non-harming and supporting the monks who are teaching the Dharma. It's interesting that he continued and said, if it so happens that the disciple of the Noble Ones in doing these things finds that his wealth goes to depletion, he feels no remorse. And if his wealth increases, he feels no remorse. He feels no remorse in either case. And so that seems to indicate that equanimity towards gain and loss as a wise action. So I thought those were interesting blessings to contemplate, and to also see that it isn't just wealth for one's own sensual pleasure. That's fine. You know, that's good. It's good to feel safe and secure and support your family or other people. But there's also a link to a greater good. The second sutta I want to share is the Anana Sutta, who was another householder. And this is called, this refers to the bliss associated with wealth. And the Buddha said that there were four kinds of bliss that can be attained in the proper season, on the proper occasions by the householder. There's the bliss of having, and that householder could say, I have wealth righteously earned through my efforts, piled up through the sweat of my brow. So one can feel bliss in knowing that you've worked hard to earn what you have. The second bliss is the bliss of making use of wealth. I partake of wealth and make merit. So this would indicate that you're using your wealth for not just yourself, but for the benefit of others. And the third bliss is the bliss of debtlessness. I owe no debt, great or small, to anyone at all. And that is a wholesome bliss to have, that you can have from wealth. The fourth bliss is called the bliss of blamelessness, and talks about a different kind of bliss of wealth, a different kind of wealth. And the householder could, with this kind of wealth, can say, I am endowed with blameless bodily, blameless verbal, and blameless mental. That householder could reflect in this verse, knowing the bliss of debtlessness and recollecting the bliss of having, enjoying the bliss of wealth, the mortal then sees clearly with discernment. Seeing clearly, now we talk about wisdom. The wise one knows both sides, that these are, and that these refers to those first three blisses, the bliss of having, the bliss of making use of wealth, and the bliss of indebtedness, that those three blisses are not worth 1/16th of the bliss of blamelessness. So again, we're weighing, you can have bliss with your wealth, but there is a greater bliss. So we can consider the words in the light of our current circumstances, these words of the Buddha, where he was talking to householders in 2,600 years ago. And the Buddha tends to offer advice to the people he's speaking to, and he might change his advice depending on who he's speaking to. So these were householders in 2,600 years ago. At that time, there was a division between the monastics and the householders who were partakers of sensuality. That's a quote. The sense doors provided their happiness. Wealth helped them obtain sensory pleasure. But generosity and merit also brought the householder rewards. Monks were described as enduring all things with patience and humility, abstaining from intoxication and heedlessness, and they restrained themselves and took themselves to unbinding, which is an awakening. I think when we consider our relationship to wealth, we need to consider where our happiness lies. And I think as followers of the Dharma that we have, one foot in the householder's view and aim and one foot in the monk's view and aim, that we have a very worldly and a spiritual aim. And so we need to weigh where our happiness lies. And that's part of relating, part of our practice. So how do we decide what to do with wealth and how to relate to it? I think the poem that Arv offered last week, Clearing by Martha Postlethwaite, is really a good way to view it. Tiwari has talked all through this month about our need to sit on the cushion with the topic of wealth, that it makes us uncomfortable and often we don't want to look at it. So the most important practice is to understand what habits and views and conditioning we have around wealth. And once we understand that, we can, with the help of actually meditation and giving a space for in any given moment, this is wise action regarding wealth. We can't really rely on what our culture tells us because, wisdom is not very high on the list. I mean, wealth seems to be more important than wisdom in our culture. We need to clear space for right action to enter, and then we'll see what to do. So the poem by Martha Postlethwaite, "Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worth of rescue."